My RN colleague Anthony Fennell is with me now. He hosts RN's Future Tense program. There's something you might not have known about him. He's an incurable romantic. So who better to examine the big question? Can you learn everything you need to know about love from reading romance fiction? Anthony.
Sarah, I think I may have actually exaggerated things a little bit. I probably could be more accurately described as a hopeless romantic rather than an incurable romantic, with the emphasis on the hopeless part. Nevertheless, I am willing to learn, and I have three experts here to help me navigate my way through matters literature and amore. So let me introduce my personal love tutors, or love tutors, as Barry White would have said. They are Amy Andrews, who writes for Mills and Boone, and is apparently still coming to terms with the realisation that she gets paid to do what she loves. Among Amy's recent titles are Driving Her Crazy and The Devil and the Deep. Next up is Helene Young, the award-winning author of the romantic suspense novel Half Moon Bay. And Helene has twice been the recipient of the Romance Writers of Australia Award for Romantic Book of the Year. And finally, romance blogger Sarah Wendell, who co-founded the popular book review website, that's romance book review website, smartbitchestrashybooks.com. And Sarah is also the author of two books on romantic fiction, including the one that gives this session its name, Everything I Know About Love, I Learned from Romance Novels. Now, in admitting that I'm a hopeless romantic, I wouldn't want to give the impression that I know nothing about love, because I do understand the theoretical and biological underpinnings of the concept, of course. And in fact, I can recall at least two instances in the late 1990s or possibly the early 2000s where I had occasion to be of a romantic persuasion, though it's possible I was drinking heavily during the second. So, Sarah Wendell, I guess the obvious opening question is, if I read enough romance fiction, can even I be redeemed?
Absolutely. And thank you for having me. This has been a great session. There you go. Absolutely you can. Because, one, if you're a man reading romance, and there are men who read romance novels, if you are a man reading romance, you are going to learn about how women think and how women approach emotions, and you're going to learn about emotional conflict, how to deal with emotional conflict, how to deal with problems, and then how to overcome them and reach your own happy ending.
Now, we know that there's a negative stereotype about romance fiction. particularly Mills and Boone, and Amy, we'll come to you about this in a second, but the name of your blog, Sarah, Smart Bitches, Trashy Books, that's an indication, isn't it, that these days some very, very smart, intelligent people are finding their way to romance fiction in a very big way.
Absolutely. Romance is written by women. It's read by women. If you go to a romance fiction conference, all of the editors, publicists, and marketers, they're mostly women. And it's about women. So it is an entirely female-focused genre, which is completely awesome. We named the site Smart Bitches, Trashy Books because we figured we were going to get some negative attention for reviewing books critically and to actually discussing what we didn't like about books. So we figured, well, we've already called ourselves bitches. What else you got? Because we started there. And we know that people assume the books are trashy, and we know that they're not. So what else you got? We were ready to sort of offset the attacks that we knew were coming by saying, yeah, you're wrong.
And
just be quiet.
In any given year, you read an awful lot of romance fiction,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, I read about 3 to 4 books a week, sometimes more. It depends on my travels and how long the flight is. Thank you, Australia. I read a lot of books. But I read an enormous number of books every year of all different genres and types within the romance field.
Now, Helene Young, it says in your bio, speaking of highly intelligent people, that when you're not writing romance fiction, you're a senior captain for a major regional airline.
Yeah, don't tell the boss, but it's quite easy to fly aircraft.
And none of us who might fly on that airline want to know what you're doing up in the cockpit. We presume you're looking out the front window.
When did you decide
that you wanted to write romance fiction as well as fly around the country?
I think I'd always just assumed I was going to write a book, and romance was my chosen genre when I eventually got round to doing it. So, you know, flying was something that gave me the time eventually to write. And I promise, I'm not writing when I'm set up in the flight deck. The boss might
when
have something
autopilot.
To say about that. Well, I've got a first officer. Passengers, they don't mind.
Oh.
Right, they don't know. It's okay. But the first officers, the interesting reactions from them when I started being published was sort of, well, is there sex in this? So you're thinking, I've got a 21-year-old male co-pilot. I'm not going to talk about sex to him. His mother can do that for him.
Now we'll come to the role. We'll come to the role and place of sex and the way it's changing in romance fiction a little later on. But just sticking with your bio, it reads, and I'll just read this. It reads, Helene Young lives aboard a catamaran moored moored off the Great Barrier Reef in the Coral Sea, and she shares her sailing adventures with her husband and her dog Zeus.
Yes.
Now that in itself sounds like the beginning of a romance novel.
Oh, please don't tell my husband that. He already thinks he's a hero in most of the books.
Is a lot of what you write inspired by real life, inspired by your travel and what you do?
It is. For me, especially the first three books are set in an aviation world, so they're set in the sort of aircraft that I fly. So what I was trying to do was bring some of the authenticity of being a working pilot into those stories. But the romance aspect, no, there's no romance in airlines, none at all.
No. Amy Andrews, let's bring you in here. Now, you write titles for Mills and Boone. Many people who've read romance fiction or know anything about it will know, and even I know this, that they changed their blue-rinsed Barbara Cartland-style image quite some time ago. But Mills and Boone, the books are still very formulaic, aren't they? Is it difficult to be creative and still keep to a prescribed formula?
Oh, Anthony, I'm so pleased you mentioned the F word. That's just...
We're not allowed to use the F word.
Formulaic.
Oh, no, just
to,
say
just
that
to clear that up.
Yeah. Never mind.
I get romance is genre fiction. So anybody who reads genre fiction knows that, you know, if you're reading a murder genre fiction, like murder mystery, you know there's going to be a good guy, there's going to be a bad guy. And at the end of it, the bad guy better lose or you're going to throw the book against the wall.
Yes.
Well, the same can be said for romance fiction. There's a girl, there's a guy, there's trials, there's tribulations. They fall in love and they have a happily ever after.
Yes.
So it's not really a formula. I guess we kind of...
More a template in a sense, is it?
Or? Yes.
Well, an outcome.
For Mills and Boone, there is actually almost like a word count, isn't there? I mean, every Mills and Boone book has the same...
Every publisher has a word count. Otherwise you'd get 400,000 word tomes and the publishers would be like, ah!
So I can't store that
there are a certain things that they look for and they want, but how you get there and what you do are so multi-nuanced and... You know, it's not... I guess what I'm trying to say is that a romance author sees red when the F word is mentioned, and not the good F word, but the bad F word being formula, because it just... All it does is box you and makes it seem what you do is less than because it's reduced to some formula.
Sarah, I know you've got a question. I'll just jump to you in a second. But, Amy, am I right in saying that Mills and Boone, really, they industrialised, if you like, romance fiction in the 1930s? The romance fiction's been around for a very long time, but they were the first to really make it accessible to the masses.
Right, exactly. Yep. Actually, Mills and Boone is actually 100 years old, so they've been around for a long time. They actually started with doctor nurse romances. So, and though I guess were the penny dreadfuls, you could go to the, you know, to the pharmacy, the drugstore, and you could buy them quite cheaply. They were mass-produced, they were paperback. But I guess, you know, they're mass-produced for a reason because many, many people like them. And I'd actually like to get back to something you said earlier about a lot of smart women are coming to read romance. Now, I would say smart women have always read romance.
Is it just that they've come out of the closet, in a sense? Is it more acceptable to say, particularly, I guess, with the growth of chick lit over recent decades, is it more acceptable to say, I read romance novels and that doesn't make me dumb? I'm highly intelligent. Mm.
I also think the e-readers made a change, that people didn't have to come out of the closet if they didn't want to, but they're certainly reading it, and they're becoming now more loud and proud about it, and I think that that's wonderful. It's wonderful that we're sitting in a festival like this, having a discussion like this.
So why has the e-reader changed it? Is it because people can read it, say, on a train without everybody else knowing they're reading it?
Without anybody else taking the mickey out of them.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Romance readers are not ashamed of the fact that they read romance. I have not ever met a romance reader who was ashamed of what they read. We are told we ought to be ashamed. Hmm. And we are told by people who are unfamiliar with the genre that we should feel ashamed and embarrassed by what we read, but we actually aren't. What we are tired of is people interrupting us while we're reading because they see the cover of the book and they're like, you know. Yeah, I know all about those. And if you have an e-reader, A, no cover, people aren't going to interrupt your reading, and B, it makes an excellent weapon. Should they attempt anyway, you just whack them.
Sarah, I saw a statistic which claimed that half of all paperbacks sold in the US at the turn of the 21st century were in fact romance fiction.
Probably.
Is that possible?
It is possible.
So it is that big. And is that the same in the UK And also Australia?
Mills and Boone romance novels sold every 4 seconds anywhere in the world.
That's right.
One every 4 seconds.
And the Romance Writers of America in the States publishes an annual statistical analysis of the genre, and they say that romance in the United States is a $1.6 billion industry annually.
Now, I've also read that it's almost exclusively an Anglo-Saxon phenomenon, at least where the writers are concerned, that most of the books are written in Anglo-Saxon countries, the United States, Australia, Canada, the UK.
That is changing very rapidly.
Yeah. Is it changing rapidly?
Oh, and
that,
yes.
I'd read that a lot of them, even the ones that are sold in Germany and France, are still translations of English romance writers. But it is changing, you reckon?
Yes. Harlequin Mills and Boone has opened publishing offices in India. They have a very active audience in a lot of Asian countries. They actually take the Harlequin romances and retranslated them into manga.
They're
gorgeous. So there is an actual effort to make romance more diverse, which I support entirely. And one of the things that's happened with the advent of self-publishing is authors who have not been able to find an audience or a publisher for their works have been able to bring them directly to readers, leading to a greater diversity of character and setting.
I want to come to the craft of putting together a romance novel in a moment. But Sarah, just staying with you, in both of the books that you've written about romance fiction as a genre, you've incorporated the opinions of readers. So what are readers telling you that they look for in romance fiction? What are they after?
There is no one type of romance reader any more than there's one type of Australian or American. Romance readers have an expectation that when they pick up a romance, there will be a story of courtship and there will be a happy ending. The dog probably won't die. The hero and heroine will definitely not die. And there is an expectation of a courtship, a trial, a problem, an obstacle overcome, and then the happy ending and the resolution of that relationship.
Helene, what distinguishes chick lit, say, from romance fiction?
Chick lit? Gee, that's a trick question. I don't read a great deal of chick lit myself.
If you kind
of
know,
actually, I think it's really another.
It's another temporary romance.
This was a question that was given to me by a woman who reads a lot of. Reads a lot of what
I would
often
say it's almost like a subgenre of romance in lots of ways, because there's usually always a huge romantic subplot. It's normally written in the first person for a start, which is not. A lot of romance novels aren't written in the first
person. Especially their third.
And it's usually, you know, it's a story of one woman who's trying to sort out a lot of stuff in her life, and romance is one element
it's
of,
one
of
woman,
that.
It's one woman's journey, so you're not tending to see so much of the hero.
It's Bridget Jones' Diary. You know,
And that was partially a romance and partially the story of her self-actualization. Chick lit is going to share the primary story with the female story of her growth. Self-actualization and growth and reaching of basically adulthood or grown-upness or having her, you know, stuff together. But also, romance is a component of that story. Yeah. If it were a contemporary romance, romance would be the primary story.
Now, I hope anybody who's sitting out there at home is taking notes on this. Get a pen and paper and start taking notes as we find out about love and also romance fiction and how it's written. And Amy Andrews, that issue of what the readers want, as a writer, how important is that for you? Because the audience is overwhelmingly female, isn't it?
Yes, definitely.
Do you sit down when you're about to write a story and do you think, what do the readers want from this? Or are you writing the story that is in you, that you want to write?
Yeah, no, I'm always usually writing the story that's in me, and then I hope that the people that read my books will, you know, go along with that story for me. I think a lot of writers, wannabe writers, often approach writing that way. What is the market doing? What's popular? What should I write? But, you know, the way publishing is, by the time you've written your book and it gets picked up, it's probably not going to be put out for another year. That fad could have come and gone. So I think you're much more authentic if you write the story that's in you and then hope that it finds an audience, which could mean that you're unpublished for many, many years. But ultimately, it's going to be a lot more authentic. I mean, I've written 30-odd books, so in lots of ways, I know what my readers like. I'm certainly mindful of that, but I'm not going to specifically write to one particular thing.
And how long did it take you from the time you started writing to your first publication?
12 years.
That's a long time.
It's four apprenticeships.
You were obviously very good by the end of it. Helene, that issue, I mean, are you writing specifically for yourself and hoping that the audience will like it?
Yeah, I think you are.
Are they in your mind, though? Do you ever get to a situation where you think, I know the audience would like my characters to do this?
No, I don't. And I'm somebody who doesn't plot my stories. I'm a what we would call a panster. So I simply start with a character, a bit of a theme, and probably an opening scene, and then I go from there. So I don't necessarily know where the story's going till I get to the end of the thing. So you're conscious that somebody will be reading it, so you're trying to make it as an emotional read as you possibly can. But am I writing particularly for a reader group? No, you're writing the stories that are in you. My first book, Border Watch, Wings of Fear, was the fifth completed manuscript that I actually managed. Mm-hmm. And it was the book where I finally wrote what was in me, which was flying and a lot of action. Up until then, I'd been trying to write straight romance and being told by everybody around me I'd put too much action in my straight romance. So why don't you write what you know?
Because you write what's called suspense romance,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah.
Sarah, you want to pick up on that?
Well, romance readers are looking for genuine emotion in their books. They're looking to empathize with the characters, and they're looking to learn about a relationship. If the author is not emotionally engaged with the book, the reader won't be either. So for the author to write a book that is emotionally engaging, that author has to be present and interested in what she's doing. So when you write a book for yourself, you know that at some point someone else is going to be interested in that same thing.
And authors are strange people that... They literally you walk around at festivals and conferences, and they talk about the people inside their heads.
Yes,
and if
yes.
you didn't know it, if you're a stranger walking to a conference, you would think that it's like a psychiatric conference or something, because there's a bunch of people talking. But honestly, it's about these people talking in your head.
Yeah.
You're not mad, you're just romance writers.
It's Prozac or it's right. You have to get them down, get them out, or take medication.
I've got a question. We said before that it's overwhelmingly a female audience.
Mm-hmm.
Overwhelmingly female writers.
Yep.
Is there any publisher, though, who does a line in men's romantic fiction?
Well, I get a lot of lovely emails from guys who read my books. Now, a lot of those are probably what we would call weekend warriors. They fly aeroplanes a little bit, or they have flown, so that was the connection. But the talk that I did at Hamilton Library this afternoon, there were a group of guys there who'd all read the books. Mm-hmm. So I think that guys perhaps come to the books from a different angle. They may not necessarily pick them up, but if their wife gives it to them, or the girlfriend, or they find it, they'll read it. And for many of them, they say that they learn a bit about the emotional connection and learn a little bit about women. So, you know.
Well, that brings us nicely on to this idea, Sarah, that you particularly promulgate on your blog, the idea that romance fiction can actually be quite a serious thing, can be a guide for better living, for healthier relationships.
Absolutely. Mm.
So talk us through that.
Romance prizes and focuses on emotions and relationships and navigating really difficult emotions. And if you've read a lot of romance, regardless of the subgenre, romance tackles really difficult topics. You mentioned whether or not there were men reading romance. Well, there's a whole subgenre of male-male romance that focuses on the relationships between two men. There's romances that focus on abuse. There's romances that focus on recovery. Any major issue that you've dealt with emotionally can be found in a romance. What you allow readers to do is empathize with the characters and go through the emotional experience of connecting with that issue in the privacy of their own imaginations. Mm. And so that's a very powerful thing to do, especially when you're culturally not really introduced with how to process really difficult emotions personally. This is a way to look at how to deal with the things that you're feeling by empathizing with another character.
Now, I have to say, being a journalist, I'm a natural skeptic about things, and I know there'll be some people out there who'll be saying, okay, that sounds nice, but how real is that? Helene, is that your experience?
Yeah, look, I do think that that's the case, and as I said, some of my lovely first officers have all read the books, and a couple of them have made the comment that, you know, they've passed them on to their father because there's an emotional content there that they don't get in action-packed books that are just written as action stories.
Mm.
So, and that's something that they hadn't tried. You know, they read it because it was my book, bless them, and they probably thought that I'd pass them in the simulator check or something. But but then, having enjoyed it, they then go and seek them out again. So, you know, I do think there's a lot to be said for that.
For a more romantic society, for more harmonious relations between the sexes,
yes.
Oh, yeah.
It would be good if more men in society actually started picking up romance.
If more people in general overcame their prejudices against the genre and read more of it, it would be a good thing for everyone.
But
men wander around all the time saying, what do women want? We don't know what they want.
There's this whole genre, dude.
It's all there between the couples.
It is.
So it's a roadmap, in a sense, to what would make a good relationship. But say, Amy, someone like yourself, are you writing that into... Are you thinking about that as well? I mean, are you signposting good messages, if you like, social messages about how we should interact with each other, how our relationship should be.
Well, I don't think I don't deliberately set out to do that, but I'm never really going to write a hero that isn't a good guy. Or, you know, good guys can always have their dark things, but essentially he's always got to be a good guy. And I write for the medical line. A lot of my romances are medical, and I particularly feel that I need to redress the gender balance because oftentimes my heroines are usually nurses and the heroes are usually doctors. And I, as a woman, feel that I'm making some statement about, you know, about the gender balance in life, and I don't mean to do that. So I always try to address it by making every other doctor in the book kind of arsehole-ish if they're male, and if they need to be in a strong female position in a hospital, I always make them, a strong leadership position, always make them female. So I try to sort of redress that sort of balance in my book, so I really feel that.
But, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, the protagonist in most romance novels these days is a woman.
There's
is
two.
Is that right?
There's the hero and the heroine.
Yeah.
And the role of the heroine, if you like, has changed, hasn't it, over time? They're the ones actually, I wouldn't say aggressive, but they're actually leading the story in a way. They're not being led through the story.
I think they reflect modern women. I think that's where romance books have evolved to the point where they reflect modern women. So that means your heroines have to be capable of being one of these women sitting here in front of us. They need to be accomplished. They need to know a little bit about where they're going, or they need to be going on that journey to that position. And that's part of why modern romances are, you know, continue to gain popularity, because we're reflecting back the society that's around us. I have female pilots.
But they're not simple, they're not passive recipients of love.
No, not at all.
No.
Not at all.
No. They were, though, weren't they, in earlier times?
Yes. I think that they, in past, that they have been, but I think that romance fiction, more than any other genre, follows the times.
Yes.
In the 80s, there are lots of secretary boss books. Now, we don't have so much of that because we, you know, it's usually, you know, the woman is, a lot of them are real kick-ass roles.
Yeah,
and they're really strong.
We have cougars and younger men now.
Exactly, and I think that it really does. Romance publishers, particularly, say, Mills and Boone, for example, know what their readers want. They're really good at marketing to their women and finding out what their readers want. So they know these things, and they, you know, their authors write, you know, they have their finger on the pulse, so... You can see that it totally reflects the times that we live in. God knows what we'll be writing in 50 years' time about our wonderful women.
And the nature, I suppose the broad spread of romance fiction, because, you know, I'm saying romance fiction all the time, but it's a broad church, isn't it? I mean, there's everything from, fantasy at one end to, I understand there's a subgenre of paranormal.
That's more than a subgenre. Yeah. That's a big genre.
Sarah, explain that to us. Take us through some of some of the different types of romance fiction that are out there today.
Basically, if you come to me and tell me what types of fiction you like, I can find a romance that you will like, because romance is an extremely fluid and welcoming genre. If you like science and fiction and fantasy, there's science fiction and fantasy romance. There's paranormal romance. There's historical romance. And then there's historical romance that takes place in the British Regency. And then there's historical romance that takes place in Victorian times, or even now, right now, the 20s, early 20s in America are a very interesting time for...
Steampunk,
which is a blend of technology and Victorian era. Yep. And then there's contemporary. There's small town contemporary. I know here in Australia, rural outback
romance,
contemporary romance, which I think is sort of like your parallel to small town contemporary in the
States.
There's
also, inspirational romance.
In an inspirational romance, depending on the publisher, there are specific guidelines about what can and cannot be included in terms of behavior of the characters, but in the course of the story, the characters will work out their relationship with each other, and they'll work out their relationship with a higher power.
Helene, as I mentioned earlier, you do what's called suspense romance, and there's a gritty edge to your novels. I mean, the Half Moon Bay starts in a helicopter over war-torn Afghanistan and goes from there. How difficult is it melding those two, keeping the romance alive throughout the novel, but also keeping the suspense and the grittiness there?
Yeah, look, I think they're intertwined. I think for me the romance and the suspense are both crucial to the story. I love the research. I get to talk to lots of hunky boys that have done things like go to Afghanistan. You're making sure that part of the action is driving that emotional journey. And, you know, we talk about romance, but it's the emotional journey. It's the emotional change between the characters that allow them to come to the point where they can accept love in their life. So going through that melting pot, and sometimes the heat is really quite intense in the suspense line, that's what's forcing them to make changes. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a, yeah, the two things are intertwined. You can't separate them out.
Amy Andrews, how would you describe the sort of romance that you write? Do you put a tag on it, if you like?
I would call it contemporary romance, contemporary sexy romance. I don't do the shutting the door stuff. Rip it off the hinges and everybody gets to look.
Contemporary is the biggie, isn't it? Contemporary, I understand, it's is the big seller.
Contemporary is also, it is a very broad church as well. Yes. It's kind of a bit of a, maybe it's a bit of a wanky label, but it's sort of something that you can say it's not inspirational. It's not, it's, well, mind you, inspirational can be contemporary
there's
as well.
There's inspirational, contemporary, and inspirational.
I mean,
historical.
Certainly for Harlequin, I write for their sexy line and I write for their medical line. So, but I've written contemporary romance for other publishers as well.
Now,
so
you write for the sexy line, and I noticed that at the front, and I'll just hold this up for the audience, and I'll explain for people listening at home. There's a little guide, if you like. It's called, what's it called? It's called the shader meter at the front of the book that gives you an indication of how hot the book will be.
Oh, it doesn't?
It does. It goes from sweet romance at the what's called the warming end all the way around past intrigue, historical, nocturne, strangely enough,
that's
desire,
paranormal.
Sexy,
that's
and then right up the top in the scorching hot is blaze.
Yes.
So where do your novels fit?
Blaze.
Oh, okay, you're right up the top.
Yeah.
Why?
Because I write contemporary romance and I'm writing about contemporary modern relationships, and I think in contemporary modern relationships, whether you morally agree with that or not, that's whatever, people have sex.
No.
And if I'm writing...
Shocking.
Shut your ears. Terrible, no, isn't it?
I'm American. You need to ease into that, right?
So shall I just spell it? Yes. And I feel if I'm exploring all parts of these people's relationships, why wouldn't I also explore that bit as well? It doesn't make sense for me not to do that. And also, sex can complicate the crap out of things as well. So that's also another issue in a story that, you know, therefore helps to drive it along. You should never put sex in just because you're bored and it's your page 56 or whatever. So, yeah.
And you're listening to a special extended Weekend Arts on RN, coming to you live from the Brisbane Writers' Festival. I'm Anthony Fennell, and this is a session on love, romance and writing. And our guests are Helene Young, the award-winning author of the romantic suspense novel Half Moon Bay, Amy Andrews, who writes for Mills and Boon, and whose recent titles include Driving Her Crazy and The Devil and the Deep. And finally, romance blogger Sarah Wendell from smartbitchestrashybooks.com. And Sarah's also the author of two works on romantic fiction, including the one that's given this session its name, Everything I Know About Love, I Learned from Romance Novels. Amy Andrews, is all romance fiction essentially based on a tease?
Oh,
that's a good one.
Is it about anticipation? Do the characters have to be teased all the way through?
No, I think if you're talking about, are you talking about a sexual tease? If you're talking about sexual tension, that absolutely adds to the book. And you can have great sexual tension in a book without ever having any of the payoff at the end, which is a bit I like. But you can have that in a book without the payoff, and it can still be amazing because you've had that amazing... Writers that can do sexual tension are just, you know, are incredible. So, I'm not setting out to tease my readers at any point in time. I'm setting out to give them the story of that couple, and if there is that tension leading, well, that more the better.
I'm going to sound like a bit of a pervert here, I know, but I've done the figures on both of your books with sex, and Amy, in The Devil and the Deep, it's page 150 before there's any congress of a horizontal variety occurring.
Wow! I'm impressed. It's normally chapter two.
That's quite a way into the book, isn't it? That's almost toward the very end. I'll come to the mango a bit later on. That's quite a way in. So there is... you don't want to come to it too early, I would imagine.
It depends on the book. But again, you're right. If you come to it too early... You can.
It's not getting any better.
You can run the risk of it all just fizzling. You know, so you need to keep on. And that's why I say about sex complicating things and always upping the stakes. It's always got to up the stakes more. Otherwise, you know, writing a book about a couple having happy times, well, that's great,
well,
but
that's
it's not.
Real, is it? Helene, here I go again. In your book, Half Moon Bay, it's page 342.
Oh, I win!
Before Ellie and Nick really start going at it.
That's
and
right.
And again, there aren't many pages left after that.
Well, no,
I don't want you to get the idea that I flicked through the book looking for the...
Because you totally didn't do that.
Look, I guess at the end of the day, it has to be true to the characters. And Ellie was not the sort of girl that was going to jump into the bed with the man that was busy trying to rape and pillage her community. She just couldn't.
Not like Slutty Stella.
No. But I have had other books where they've hopped into bed a little earlier than that.
Okay. And Amy, let's go to the mango.
Oh, good.
Because in your novel, The Devil in the Deep, and I'll come back to that one again, I obviously liked that one, it stuck in my mind, although the other one is quite nice, thank you. The erotic consumption of mango and other soft fruits is thoroughly explored, I have to say.
Yes,
so
yes.
How difficult is it to write sex scenes that are romantic and erotic and different and not kind of fall over that line into farce or just silliness?
I think they're kind of organic as well. I didn't set out at the beginning of the book to write a scene where a mango was involved. That just kind of evolved in the book itself. And, I mean, I've written, like, 38, I think, romances now, so there's always that kind of, oh, they're going to have sex again, what am I going to write about now? I've described every position I can, and it doesn't kind of get to that because it's always very organic to the book, what they would do. I've had books where I planned to have the hero and heroine have sex in chapter 2. One book I couldn't get him to do it till chapter 10. And I was
they could be like that
yeah,
sometimes.
God,
just
course.
Do it already.
Yeah, yeah.
And other times I've not planned for them to have sex so much later and they're like doing it in chapter 1 and yep. I'm like, whoa, what happened there?
Yep.
So oftentimes we don't have much control over the sex lives of our characters.
No. Sarah, you've read an awful lot of romance.
Yes,
is there a continuity with the use of sex in romance books?
Oh, every book is different. You could have books with erotic content throughout the entire book and it's entirely full of sexual tension. You could have books where there's sexual interaction and it's the least sexy thing in the book itself and the intimacy comes from some other part of the novel. You could have books with really hot hand holding and that's all you get. There's
hot,
a whole
hot hand holding.
Just some holding hands and then they shut the door. The development of sexual tension is separate from the actual presence of sex in a novel. Sexual tension does not require a sex scene. And it is actually very, very difficult to write good sex. It is enormously easy to write it badly.
When does it go from being romance fiction to erotica then?
Well, erotic romance rests very heavily on the sexual interaction of the characters. Erotic romance deals primarily in the sexual relationship of the characters and in finding resolution to some aspect of that interaction. The sexual interaction of the characters occurs primarily in the book as part of the... I'm trying to avoid a really unpleasant euphemism here. The sexuality exists as part of the plot. Mm-hmm. The plot rests very much on their sexual interaction. And in erotic romance, you could have any number of sexual activities, especially things that are not as commonly explored. Part of, I think, the attractions with 50 Shades was that there were many people who had no idea that BDSM was a thing that was done by people. And the nice thing about romance and sexuality in romance is it gives you the opportunity to learn about your own sexuality in the privacy of your own mind. No one knows what you're reading about, and you get to explore what you think is interesting. And it's totally your business.
My grandmother used to read a lot of Mills and Boons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tell me she wasn't reading
I'm
sexually
sorry,
explicit stuff.
When did it start coming in?
When did romance novels start becoming more explicit and less coy?
Well, you don't think that older people should be reading sexually explicit
stuff?
No,
I think they should.
I think they should,
but it might, might disturb my memory, though.
You would be surprised.
This is like 30 years ago. I guess my question is, When were they allowed to become a bit more racy?
They were always somewhat sexy. Yeah. They were always somewhat about the emotional and sexual journey of the characters. Whether or not that was explicitly detailed in the story, sexual tension was always present.
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised how many romance readers have experienced romance as a literary inheritance from an older female relative. We receive romances from our mothers, our aunts, our grandmothers, our sisters. Women who are older than us are the ones who show us what romances are and give us our first books. This is a very much female-centered literary inheritance.
I think probably in the 70s, was it? They kind of got...
more and more explicit.
Yeah. More and more explicit with the chic-y kind of books, and, or chic-shaky kind of books. Was it the Dove and the Caffeine? Would it,
the Wolf and the Dove?
Yes. Yeah, those... Like the
Flame and the Flower?
Those kind of books are more... Well, there were lots of things about those books, but I think
they're very
were,
different than the historical romances being published today.
Yes, yeah.
There's a lot that's acceptable now. I mean, same-sex relationships would be acceptable in romance novels.
Like society.
What about, though, adultery, I wonder? Does that kind of fit in? Is adultery... Is it there in romance novels? It's obviously part of our society.
There are some, but there are many readers who dislike it because part of the goal of a romance is to explore the commitment between the characters, and adultery compromises that. But there are some very powerful books that do explore the aftermath of adultery.
Yes, the aftermath. That's what I was going to say.
Absolutely.
That you could have adultery as somebody's backstory. That's the reason they've come to this point in their life, because they've been damaged by somebody previously in a relationship, and that then leads on. So, you know, it can be the background context to the growing romance.
But if they're committing adultery, if their romance is
you'd have a hard time redeeming them for your readers.
It'd be very hard to redeem that person for many readers.
And the role of the male in romance fiction, tell me how that has changed over time.
He has his own journey too. I think romance readers now especially expect a journey for the hero and for the heroine. It is not enough for the hero to show up like the groom at the wedding and be like, I'm here. Thank you very much. Like, that does not satisfy the romance reader. The reader wants both the hero and the heroine's journey, and they complement one another.
Mm. Helene, tell me about the sort of male characters that you include in your romance.
I guess mine, a lot of them tend to be sort of the damaged servicemen, firemen, guys that have had some trauma in their life and that have to work their way through that. So they tend to be the sorts of guys that are used to being in a fairly high-powered position, hence my heroines then have to complement that and be of an equal firepower.
Why trauma? Does that make them more vulnerable in a sense?
Perhaps, and that's maybe it's the sort of males that I quite just, you know, like exploring the psyche
damaged
of.
Men.
Damaged men.
Well,
yes.
I'm damaged, so. You know.
Just wait till the end of the book.
Very nice to meet you.
Let's get out your pen.
Yes, that's right. Can we talk
Amy, tell
nice?
Me, tell me about. Picking up on that question, tell me about the sorts of males that you write about.
Like I said before...
They like fruit.
Well, fruit's very good for you, Anthony. So, like I said before, I write for the medical line, so a lot of my characters are doctors. So with that comes a lot of, you know, I guess power and prestige. And so I do tend to write sort of powerful men, but I do that for medical line, but when I write for the sexy line, I like a man in a tool belt. Like, I like a cowboy. I like men that are really capable. So when I'm not writing my doctors who have to save the world, I do like to write a man who's a bit kind of confounded by, that's very male and it's kind of confounded by women and can fix stuff.
But as a writer, there'd be a danger, wouldn't there, of course, of falling into stereotype. You wouldn't want to do that.
Mm-mm. Well, that's all about just not making your characters a cardboard cutout. You know, you've got the cowboy. Okay, I'm going to write a cowboy book. Good cowboy. But it's more than sticking on boots with a spur and having a horse.
And the tool belt.
and the tool belt, preferably without the shirt, but that's completely, you know, you can do that if you like. It's about giving them, making them damaged, giving them a story, you know, giving them a point of view. More, I would say that the majority of romance novels, particularly Mills and Boone, for example, would have both hero and heroine point of view, so you actually get to see inside the hero's head and know what's going on and have that story told through his point of view rather than the heroine thinking, oh, I wonder what's going on there with his frowny looks and his tool belt.
and bare chest.
Now, unless you're dealing with a narcissist, you need at least two people for a romance. There's the classic romantic...
Not there's anything wrong with self-love.
I have something came into my head then, but it's best not to go there. We have the classic love triangle. Can you bring in more characters into love? How many could you bring in, though, Sarah, without it being too complicated?
How skilled is the writer? I mean, there are definitely lines
with... So people do.
Oh, yeah. Emma Hawley is a writer who has done polyamory and triad romances. Lauren Dane writes triad romances. You can absolutely have more than two people if that is the way the story is going.
You'd have to have a little chart for the characters at the front, wouldn't you, I think, to follow. Would you ever consider more than two, maybe three characters?
Yeah, the book that I'm writing at the moment is a bit problematic because the guy that was supposed to get the girl may not get the girl anymore because there's this other chappie who they rescued from the water who's gorgeous, which was not the way I set to write the story. But, you know, we're not in control of these characters. And I know that makes us sound mad, but we're not. So, and we're not mad either.
And when you are a reader who values a character who is realistic, as a writer, if you're going to craft a character that is realistic, then that character is going to assume a personality. Mm. And the things that you have created in that person, that is then going to just steer that character into different directions. So if you hear a writer saying, well, the character wouldn't do that, that's because that person has created a character that is so real. They have a moral compass that's going to steer them through the course of the story. And if the writer wanted them to go that way and the character has not been created that way, they're not going to do it.
That, as an example, Half Moon Bay, they did actually have a kiss in an earlier version, much earlier in the story. It just wasn't working because that was just not the way Ellie would have actually behaved. So eventually, once I took that out, the rest of it flowed from there.
And poor old Nick had to wait to page 345.
Very good for him.
We're fast running out of time, but I want to get an idea. I think a lot of people would... I think this is the thing with all writers, but with romance fiction, want to know about the way in which you write, the routine that you have. So, Amy, let's start with you. Tell me about the setup that you have at home, how you write, when you write, what inspires you to write, how you get in the mood, a bit of Barry White maybe, in the background.
I have to write to silence. I can't write to music at all because what I find when I am writing to music, I'm either listening to the music or I'm writing. Therefore, I'm not listening to the music, so my mind will be off. So I have my own home office. I have my computer. I don't wait to get into the mood because I have a contract that I have to fulfill. I have to sit my backside in the chair every day. And on a good day, I can write 4,000 words. On a bad day, my eyes are bleeding after 100. And I'm like, why? Why do I do this? So it varies, but I can't just wait for the mood to hit. It's like any job. You have good days and you have bad days. So,
Helene?
Obviously, with the flying roster, I just have to write when I can, and that can be sitting in an aircraft back end when I'm not flying, of course. It can be sitting in a departure lounge, and, you know, I'm the same as Amy. You have a job to do, and part of that job is putting words on the page. So the muse knows better than to say she's not turning up for the day or she'd be in trouble. On the boat, it has been a little interesting because my husband keeps coming and interrupting now. It was good in the house. You could shut the door. It's a little harder sitting on the deck of the boat going, can you go away and play with the neighbours or the dog or something because I'm writing. But you have to keep going, and you sometimes those words, as Amy said, are really torn from you. Other times, 5,000 words a day, and that's a good day.
And how do your how do your partners feel about romance fiction? When the books, just before it's been published, do they try and sneak a bit of a look to see whether you've put in anything that you perhaps shouldn't?
My husband would rather stab himself in the eye with a hot poker than read one of my books. So, you know, he read one once and then he got really concerned in the sex scene that he's like, oh, do you want to really, like, no, it's not me. It's not you. It's like, I'm like, you know what, just don't read it anymore. Oh, no. He does stuff with the kids. He's happy to eat cornflakes for tea if I'm on deadline. He, you know, is extremely supportive in every other way. He's probably listening. I shouldn't have said that bit that before. He's supportive. It's interesting how it changed from when I was trying to get published than when I was published. It was a bit like, oh, come on, what are you doing to this? You know, a bit kind of grouchy about why things weren't being done or whatever. And then I started to get paid. And it was like, children, leave your mother alone. She's writing. So that worked.
Love is the language that money speaks. Helene, your partner.
Yeah, my partner's extremely, extremely supportive of the whole thing, and he's very, very happy to tell people that I write books and all
the rest.
Is he
a bit of a bouncing board, a sounding board for scenarios? For
exactly,
plots,
he can never remember one book from the other, so if I start talking, he goes, well, which book's that in again? Oh, for goodness sake. But he is what we call my BS detector. He's not a reader. He reads the first draft with a yellow highlighter in his hand, and if he finds something he doesn't like, he puts a line through it and writes BS down the side of it. And I know that I've obviously overcomplicated it and I need to fix it. But after that, he doesn't read the book again.
When you're writing romance fiction, what comes first, plot or characters?
for me, the character in an opening scene and a bit of a theme. So, you know, Half Moon Bay was really, the theme is about family and the lies that we tell and the secrets that we keep from each other. So that was the starting point. And I had Ellie and I had the setting, and the rest of the story just...
Amy?
It depends. Yeah, sometimes I can get a scene in my head that's so crystal clear and I don't know anything about it except that I need to write that story. With The Devil in the Deep, it started out with the title, which was actually Pleasure Hunt. It wasn't The Devil in the Deep at all. It got changed. But, you know, I had this title, and come hell or high water, I was going to get a story to fit that title. So, yeah, it's different for different books. So.
The title change, I presume the publishers came to you to say they wanted a different title. Is that correct?
Yeah, okay, we'll say that.
They said
we're going to change it to The Devil in the Deep.
Right.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
Great.
Yeah.
I was going to lead on to the role that publishers and editors have in shaping your manuscript. Do they have much input? Once you've handed them the original manuscript, how much changing goes on?
It depends. When I was a baby writer, a lot more. Less now, because I guess I really know what I'm doing. So, but I would never want to do it without an editor. They're gold. They can take the book, and because you're so close to it, even though by the time you send it away, you generally hate it. You hate it because you love it so much. You're so close to it, you can't see the wood for the trees, and they can, you know, come along and they can really make a great book better. Mm-hmm. So I would never in a million years want to give up my editor for...
Have they ever asked you to spice it up or tone it down?
They didn't ask me to... cut a very long sex scene once, but apart from that, no, they're pretty, they let me kind of do my thing.
Helene, have you got to...
We just have a little lovely romantic moment over the back with a bride.
Oh, for people listening to the broadcast, we actually have a wedding, wedding pictures being taken. There's a bride and groom appropriately behind us here at the Brisbane Writers Festival. Helene, the role of your editor. Do you have a good editor?
I've had nothing but wonderful editorial experiences, which has been fantastic. So Bernadette Foley was my first editor, taught me so much about crafting the story. My current editor is Ali Watts, and she has given me permission to put so much more emotion in there, and it's been wonderful. She's, as in, just write some more. So I've written some more and written some more, thinking this book is growing like Jack and the Beanstalk. This is nuts.
And do they specifically, are they editors who deal with romance predominantly?
I think editors acquire books that they like to read. So Ali obviously reads a lot of romance herself and books with a strong emotional content. So because of that, she's great for editing those sorts of books.
Sarah Wendell, your thoughts?
Well, the author's name is on the front of the book, but if you go through a publishing house, a lot of people have a role in creating the finished product of a book. There's editors, there's line editors, and there's content editors, there's copy editors, and then there's people who develop the cover and the marketing and how the book is going to be promoted. All of those people have roles within the publishing house. And so, on one hand, the author's name is on the front, and so the author is getting the lion's share of the credit, which is excellent. And sometimes, if decisions are made that the author has no control over, like the cover art that doesn't reflect the interior of the book, the author is then the one to hear about it, even though she had nothing to do with it. So it's both it's a blessing and a curse.
Yes.
But unless you're reading a self-published book that's not edited, and generally speaking, I do not recommend doing that, one book may have many, many people.
A village.
Yes, it takes a good number of people to actually create the finished product, especially if it's a good one.
Sarah, you obviously, before you started your blog, read an awful lot of romance fiction. I just wonder, Amy and Helene, were you big romance fiction readers when you were young?
Yeah.
Before you really got into writing?
Yeah, I started reading, I think, I was sneaking off my mum's sexy red Harlequins at like 11 or 12. So I'd always, well, I mean, I read a lot of things, but I always read Harlequins. So,
and I read a little bit of romance when I was in high school, but then didn't really read as much romance until I sat down to write. So, and my books, I guess, reflect the fact that I read a lot of Jean Le Carré and spy stories and suspense stories and murder mysteries. Mm.
One thing I haven't asked about is setting. Mm. The importance of having a good setting. Immediately comes to mind, and this will be a stereotype, but the island romance, two people on an island, you know, isolated from their normal environment, thrust together on this... maybe I shouldn't go on this island. Obviously, I might get out of broadcasting and go into writing romance fiction. Tell us about setting.
think that setting is important, but it, like anything, it's just the background to... In a romance, I'm particularly talking about Harlequin here, really the main story is about the hero and the heroine. So setting is important, and setting can almost be another character in the book. I wrote a road trip, straight out, but road trip story, and a lot of the setting was, you know, it was almost like a third character. And I think in a lot of Helene's books, her settings are
deliberate
as well.
To make the setting as a character in the book. And, you know, the first three books were set in North Queensland, something that I really knew and loved, and something that either people have wonderful fond memories of great holidays in Cairns and North Queensland, or they've never been there but they'd like to go. So you're bringing that to life for them. And for me, part of what I want to do is transport the reader into that world and into that space.
And I love when setting is a character, because when setting is a primary character or a large part of the book, I get to travel without having to get off my couch.
Yes.
Exactly. I can go to Australia. I can go back in time. I can go to another country. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Is there a perfect setting, Sarah? Is there one type of setting that really stands out when you look at the vast amount of romance fiction that you've reviewed?
Cowboy.
You know, it's funny. I don't actually like cowboy romances all that much. That's not my my genre cup of tea. I think the best setting is the one that works best with the characters and the authors. There's some authors who are so talented at creating a setting and creating an environment, and then there's some where the characters are the flavor of the romance.
Now, we're right toward the end, so we have to be quick with this. An uplifting ending, an optimistic ending to the book, is that crucial to good romance fiction?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
That's romance.
Yeah,
pretty
much.
Romance.
So you can't have...
That's the contract. You have.
Do not kill anybody. Do not kill the hero or the heroine at the end.
No, bad idea.
And don't kill the dog.
Black mark.
Don't kill the dog.
And just a final...
Don't kill the dog. Don't kill the dog.
Please don't kill the dog.
A final question. Authors are a little bit like journalists and broadcasters. They can be a lofty lot. When you come to a writer's festival, do some of them look down on you when they find out that you're doing romance fiction? What's the reaction you get from people? Why are you laughing?
Well, I can't imagine.
Well, actually, I think that I don't think romance writers are lofty people at all, because we're kind of used to being at the bottom of the pile, used to being looked down upon. So our expectations are so, so low. The fact that we're here, we're like scratching our head and shaking our
head. And I don't think we take ourselves too seriously.
Nope.
I think, you know, at the end of the day.
And because we're women writers, I think there's an amazing camaraderie with romance writers.
Right.
When we get together, it's just, you know,
it's
a fantastic feeling.
Well, unfortunately, that's where we'll have to leave it for this session. Everything I know about love, I learned from romance novels. Our guests were blogger Sarah Wendell from the book review site smartbitchestrashybooks.com, Amy Andrews, who writes for Mills and Boone, and one of her recent books is The Devil and the Deep, and Helene Young, the award-winning author of the romantic suspense novel Half Moon Bay.